It's the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Good to have you along on this Friday. Well, the city of Evansville has a long baseball history, including Bossy Field, the third oldest ballpark still in regular use in the United States, and the current home of the Evansville Otters. But could the city be in line for a new team? Joining me now is John Martin of Evansville Living Magazine. He's the author of a story in the latest issue called Better Up. That's with a question mark. John, as always, appreciate you joining us.
Good to be back, John.
Wonderful to have you here. Well, in this article, you write that Evansville is positioning itself for a possible new minor league affiliate. Can you share with us what you've learned?
It's been going on in the background for a little while, John, but I think it's safe to say it's out in the open now, particularly given the push to try to get legislation passed that would have facilitated some initial funding for a new ballpark. That's when it became much more public knowledge.
Sure.
What Evansville is interested in is they have been in touch with Music City Baseball, which is the grassroots organization trying to get a major league expansion team in Nashville, and with the hope and intent of possibly affiliating with them when baseball does expand in the next several years, if in fact Nashville does get a team.
Right.
And this would involve building a new ballpark in Evansville, most likely on the river. They have not pinpointed exactly where it could, would, or could be, but I haven't heard any non-downtown scenarios. So that's where it is. The legislation that was introduced by Tim O'Brien during the last General Assembly, all of the local legislators were co-sponsors of it. They were all in. The mayor went up and testified, as did business leaders, to try to get it passed. What it did, or what it proposed to do, was to increase the taxes collected within the professional sports and convention development area here from the current $1.2 million to $5
million. I see.
It passed, sort of. They didn't increase the cap to $5 million. They increased it to $2 million. So Evansville got a little bit of what they were wanting, but not all of it. So, but anyway, all that being said, yes, I mean, there is interest in a new ballpark and trying to work behind the scenes to get that, well, not just behind the scenes, but out in the open now to get that done.
Well, who is leading the effort? Is it mostly EREP, the group that we refer to as EREP?
I feel like they are kind of in the driver's seat, John, in addition to the Evansville Regional Business Council, which are loosely defined. Those are the CEOs of major companies here. I think those are the entities that are, for the most part, in the driver's seat. Mayor Terry certainly is involved. I mean, she was at the State House lobbying for passage of the legislation. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, it's being driven by the business community.
I see. And, of course, EREP is led these days by the former mayor, Lloyd Winicky, correct?
That is correct.
And is he does he seem to be the main out front leader in this effort?
I can tell you what he has said.
Yeah.
What he has told us is that Music City Baseball continues to express interest in Evansville as a potential affiliate site if Major League Baseball awards Nashville an expansion team.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he has said. We understand a decision by MLB may not come until early 2027. As an aside, that would be after the next collective bargaining agreement between the league and the players gets passed. That basically governs the sport of baseball.
Yeah.
But Winicky goes on, in the meantime, a group of local leaders continue to explore what a potential Nashville-Evansville relationship might look like. That due diligence includes contemplating construction of a downtown multi-use sports entertainment venue. It's too early to identify an exact location, financing structure, or team ownership. He goes on to say, or pleased that the recent legislative action championed by Representative O'Brien allows the city to capture additional state revenue through its expanded taxing district.
Right.
And this could serve as foundational funding for a downtown facility.
Yeah. Now, this effort, you know, it might be perking up lots of people's ears as we talk about it here. I'm guessing quite a few folks would have this simple question, why not Bossy Field?
Bossy Field was built in 1915, and of course it was the site of an affiliated minor league team affiliated with Major League Baseball at one time.
Right.
That went away in 1985 when the Triplets left. Since then, the standards for minor league facilities that are affiliated with the major leagues have really increased.
Yeah.
Everything that I've always been told is that Bossy Field, getting Bossy Field in that condition probably is not an option.
I guess it's cost prohibitive, as they would say.
Cost prohibitive. I mean, you know, there are regulations for dugouts, clubhouses, mm-hmm. All of the facilities, and I, from what I've always been told, getting Bossy Field in that condition would be a stretch given its age.
Yeah, yeah. Now, of course, other folks might point out that, well, Wrigley Field, Fenway Park, those are century-plus old ballparks, and they're still very attractive. But I guess, are we talking apples and oranges here?
I think we're talking apples and oranges, and, you know, to go back to 2022, mm-hmm. There was discussion at that time with the city. The city prioritized at that time trying to upgrade Bossy Field for a one-off Major League Baseball game, kind of a Field of Dreams type game, similar mm-hmm. to there are a couple of games in the cornfields in Iowa where they shot the Field of Dreams movie. Then there was one in Alabama
at Birmingham
at the historic Negro Leagues ballpark there.
Right.
There's discussion as recently as 2022 and trying to get Bossy Field in good enough shape for that type of event, which would be kind of a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have gone away, or I don't know if that's off the table entirely, but it certainly is on the way back burner. And what has supplanted that is the push toward a new ballpark. But from what I've always been told, John, is just Bossy Field, getting Bossy Field in condition for a full-time minor league team affiliated with Major League Baseball just isn't something that would work.
I see. We're speaking with John Martin of Evansville Living. You can find this story and all of his stories at evansvilleliving.com. John, let's talk a little bit about former New York Yankee star and Evansville native Don Mattingly. Is he somehow involved in this this proposal?
Well, Music City Baseball identified him in 2023 as being a consultant to the effort to try to get a minor league team, a major league affiliate in Nashville. He came through Nashville when he was in the minor leagues on his way up to the Yankees during his ascent to the major leagues as a player. So he may still have relationships there. Obviously, Don Mattingly, there's no more dedicated advocate for this city than he is. So he is present in the Nashville effort to try to get an expansion team. And obviously, he has that longstanding connection to Evansville.
Yeah. This is the Friday Wrap on WNIN. Now, listeners, John, might remember, I know you and I remember it, an effort in the early 2000s to bring an affiliated team and a new ballpark to Evansville under the Russ Lloyd Jr. administration. Lots of bells are ringing in my head. This sounds similar somewhat to that effort. Now, that effort was eventually scrapped over cost concerns and support for the Otters and Bossy Field. Do those concerns and that loyalty remain?
You know, John, that's a huge question in my mind. I was here too when that was going on.
Right.
And a big reason why that effort stalled was, I feel, and I think you do too, the public sentiment for a new ballpark at that time just wasn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of love for Bossy Field. It's been there since 1915. It's a part of this community's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now more than 20 years have passed. So a key question in my mind is going to be, as this goes forward, has that changed? You know, has the public's viewpoint of a potential new ballpark, are they warmer to that now than they were 20-plus years ago?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Right.
I will say that I think the advocates for the new ballpark, whoever they may be, as I said earlier, it seems to be driven by the business community, whoever is the torchbearer for that project is going to need to really think hard about messaging, how it's presented, why they feel it's needed,
mm-hmm.
and probably also articulate a plan to preserve Bossy Field in some form or fashion. I've seen baseball a lot of places. I mean, there's something to be said for affiliated play,
mm-hmm.
You know, modern amenities, better sight lines in the field, more parking, easier parking, all of those types of things. So I think a case could be made, but at the same time, people are going to want to know what the future of Bossy Field is going to be if they build a new ballpark here.
Right, right. And I'll note that effort back in the early 2000s, it included a rally featuring the late L.A. Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda and Baltimore's Cal Ripken Jr. Those plans called for a new minor league park near Fulton Avenue and 2nd Street here in the downtown area. But as we mentioned, that effort did eventually go away. The mayor decided to kill it when the public support just didn't seem to be there. So, in this process, if we're looking at this kind of effort, what would the next steps be, John?
Well, the next steps would be identifying funding. Well, let's back up. Identifying funding for a ballpark, but also seeing what happens with the expansion process in Major League Baseball. I mean, we don't know for sure that Nashville is going to get a team. They seem to be at the head of the line when Major League Baseball does expand. They've been the Nashville group has been working on this for some time. It's not new. And, of course, Nashville is a boom town. I mean, they've already got the NFL, and they're getting ready to move into a second NFL stadium. It's been there that long.
Right.
Hockey is doing well. So there's little doubt that Nashville could support baseball. If Nashville gets a team, then the minor league affiliates would be selected. And Evansville obviously wants to be, well, it seems to want to be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then the timeline would have to line up, right? I mean, if Evansville is selected as an affiliate of a Nashville major league team,
right,
then it becomes an issue of timing. When can you get a stadium built?
Sure.
How fast? You know, when would the minor league team start to play? All of those things would have to marry up time-wise.
Yeah, yeah, and that's that I'm sure is a many-year process. We mentioned, yeah, Nashville does seem to be certainly one of the favored cities to get a ballpark. Some other cities that have been mentioned: Salt Lake City, Portland, Charlotte, Montreal, which of course once had Major League Baseball. But does not anymore, at least not at this point. Well, John, fascinating article. Interesting to see what is being talked about here. Is there anything more to add that we haven't touched on?
Don't think so, John. Like I said, I as we were talking, I think public sentiment is going to be interesting to watch as this continues to evolve. It's still really early, you know. We don't even know for sure when expansion will occur. Or anything like that, but it's something that Evansville is thinking about,
sure,
is interested in exploring. And I think if building public support for this is going to be a goal, then messaging and articulating that clearly, why it's a need, that type of thing is going to be critical for the advocates for a new stadium.
Yeah, yes, indeed. We will keep our eyes on that. Should be fascinating. That is John Martin of Evansville Living Magazine. You can find this story and all of his stories at evansvilleliving.com. As always, John, thank you so much for joining us on the Friday Wrap.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, coming up on the Friday Wrap, WNIN's Tim Jagalow will join us. We'll listen back to his story from Angel Mounds. There was a traditional and rather modern native plant, some corn growth there at Angel Mounds. We'll hear all about that. He can tell it better than I can, obviously. This is the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. Hope you can stay with us. It's the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Good to have you along on this Friday. Well, Angel Mounds State Historic Site recently hosted an agricultural demonstration. The project included cutting-edge technology and traditional native planting techniques. WNIN's Tim Jagalow filed this report.
And then you can go just like that after you put her in the ground. Then you take the stick again and you just lean it like this. You find your next spot.
Squatting near the large prepared garden plot, Shawnee farmer Ryan Conway is instructing a volunteer.
Take it out, you place the corn, and then you cover it again.
Conway and his wife Andrea are demonstrating a traditional corn planting technique that happened at this spot 600 years ago. This was by the Mississippian native tribe between 1100 and 1425 CE. The type of agriculture was identified with ground-penetrating radar and precision excavation by the Archaeology Department of Indiana University, where Conway is an indigenous research associate.
With the ground-penetrating radar and the very high-precision excavation, they were able to discover that the agricultural system here at Angel Mounds was a ridge and furrow-based system. So it wasn't like a mounded hill for corns, beans, and squash. It was a system of high ridges and low furrows. The furrows help prevent erosion, and also they catch water that gets fed back into the soil that gets into them plant roots. And so part of what we're doing here today is working up a living demonstration of that most cutting-edge research so that folks that come here to visit Angel Mounds can see with more detail what kind of agriculture was being practiced here on site.
They fill and haul buckets with dark, wet compost to the front of the neatly dug rows for planting. Andrea says because the spot used to be a farm, the soil is now mostly clay, devoid of nutrients, so the compost is very important. She spreads the compost with her bare hands.
And so that will add nutrition to the soil, but also it helps with the organic matter. It helps retain any nutrients that are in the soil. So we're just adding a little layer of compost, and then we're putting the seed into it, right below it. Compost also retains a lot of water, which in this case, clearly, it doesn't seem like we need, but like we don't know what's going to happen in a couple months, and it might get dry. So compost helps retain water also.
Joaquin Rangio is Navajo, and he's volunteering. He feels that anyone, native or non-native, can learn from such demonstrations about the people who lived here centuries ago.
They lived the way they did. They ate the way they did because they were more part of their environment and saw themselves kind of connected in it all. And I think that's something that anyone can learn from and return to. I think it's important to get that connection back when we see ourselves so separated from nature and our food sources, even like what we had before. But
again, Ryan Conway.
So it's something that we all can get back to. It's something that's very much a part of all of us. Like our foodways are what sustain us. And practicing agriculture in this way is a way that also clearly brings people together. So this is work that can be shared with families, with groups of friends. And it's work that we like to do collaboratively. So
in the muddy compost, they planted more than 1,000 corn kernels, which will be popping up in a few weeks and could be harvested in September. For WNIN News, I'm Tim Jagelow.
And Tim joins us now on the Friday Wrap. Tim, thanks for the time.
Of course, of course.
All right. Well, let's talk a little more about this. Can you share more on the way this discovery was made? It sounds fascinating.
Well, it actually starts all the way back in 2020. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was based on a study that was released in the fall of 2023. And it was led by Indiana University's Edward Herman. He's a research scientist there. Mm-hmm. But their evidence for these ridge and furrow plantings were date back more than 1,000 years.
Right.
And you know the findings were published in the Journal of Field Archaeology in September of 2023. But like I said, this all started in 2020, where Dr. Herman and a native consultant were investigating a spot for possible pollinator garden in that area, mm-hmm. at Angel Mounds.
Right.
And so that's when they discovered or they noticed that there were dark linear furrows underground. Mm-hmm. And they kind of figured that they weren't modern. And so they started using ground radar. And, they were ID'd, actually. The furrows were ID'd by slight differences in soil composition, which is interesting to me.
Yeah.
And, there was doubt on whether these were actual archaeological finds because these systems hadn't been found this far south in Indiana yet. And so they kind of had to keep like finding evidence and confirming, you know.
Right, right.
They had I wrote this down in three parts. A paleoethnobotanist was able to identify plant remains or plant evidence in the furrows, which showed evidence of purposeful planting of beans, maize, and bottle gourds in those furrows at that spot. And so, you know, they looked at macro level at the soil, then they saw that it hadn't been disturbed by mechanical means, like, you know, like a hoe.
Sure.
And they basically determined that this had been used in three eras. starting at 900 AD, and then again at 1100 to 1425, those would be the Mississippians.
Right.
And again, actually, in late 18th to early 19th century, the pre-Euro-American settlers. And so it was used before and after the Mississippians.
Yeah.
And they expect that because they found it this way, they'll find older and more such sites around southern Indiana.
Yeah, as they keep looking. Well, for those who don't know, could you tell us a little more about the Mississippian people who lived there, here, basically, centuries ago?
Yes, and I use the word tribe in the story. I don't think that's actually technically the right word. It could have been more tribes as part of the Mississippians. But, again, these are the people that are commonly believed to have created what ended up being the mounds themselves. But the mounds are an evidence of a city, actually, that was at that spot. And, a powerful city until around, 1200 AD. It was abandoned after about 300 years of use, they think. And the Mississippians, according to Britannica, not my own knowledge, were the last major prehistoric cultural development in North America. And one thing that's common to the Mississippians who existed in the Midwest and the South were the corn cultivation being very important, among other crops.
As it still is, of course.
Yeah, and they're located near the rivers, so that's why. And so, these Mississippian towns usually contain like a large central plaza. And those were more in south central U.S. and South America. But, the Mississippians are the one that brought that to the Midwest, up to this area this far north. And archaeologists believe that the government of the Mississippians were priest rulers. Hmm. And they actually used the word cult in their descriptions.
So how long did this garden preparation and this planting take?
Well, like I said, this is a project 5 years in the making,
right?
Because they discovered it, 5 years ago and pronounced their findings in 2023. And so anyways, the site was already an archaeological dig. So there was already a layer of, layer dug down in like a perfect square in that spot.
Right.
And so it was already dug down during the investigation. But for the planting, Ryan Conway said it took 3 days, basically. So they took some time to prepare the ridge and furrow system based on the Indiana University research. They had to hand set the compost, which you heard happen, and then they had to plant the individual corn kernels, which was about 6 to 7 hours. Mm-hmm. In a couple of weeks, the corn should start to become visible, and Angel Mounds is planning on Native America Days, September 27th and 28th this year, which at that point it should be fully harvestable, grown.
Yeah, that will be fascinating. Well, in your web post, you mentioned the type of corn that was used. Why is that significant?
Well, it's called Tenskwatawa Flint corn, and that originated in Prophetstown, which is near West Lafayette.
Okay.
And it's symbolic. It's been preserved for generations. And Ryan said he called it an amalgam corn, a combination of 10 to 15 other strains of corn.
I see.
And again, preserved for generations. And so he thinks his planting is symbolic because of the diversity of the corn strains that went into that, the diversity of the people around here, and the people that have lived here for generations.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, Tim, anything else to add that we haven't touched on here?
No, it was just a fun story to cover. And I love stories like this because they do have the fun sounds that go along with it, and they also have the fun visuals to go along with it as well.
That is WNIN's Tim Jagalo. Tim, as always, thank you so much.
No problem, of course.
We appreciate that. Well, coming up on the Friday Wrap, our Kenton McDonald will speak with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel about the future of solar power in the Hoosier State. That's coming up on the Friday Wrap, along with the Sports Chat and the Weekend Notebook. Hope you can stay with us. It's the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Glad you could join us today. Indiana is expected to add a lot of solar power in the next 5 years, roughly equal to more than 5 Hoover dams. Most of that will be on the ground, something that some rural Hoosiers don't like. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports there could be another option: put solar on hundreds of millions of square feet of unused space on top of big box stores and warehouses. WNIN's Kenton McDonald spoke with Rebecca following this report.
Here at Sweetwater Sounds Distribution Center in Fort Wayne, employees test out guitars before boxing them back up to sell.
Make sure there's no higher on the frets.
There's a lot of activity. Boxes zoom from place to place on overhead conveyor belts, while forklift drivers make their way through traffic on the floor. But it's nothing compared to the energy on the roof. There, more than 260 solar panels help power the building. Tyler Gerardo maintains them for the company.
We do try to use what we can here, and then what is left over and not used by Sweetwater, we send back out to the grid, and that helps kind of reduce the price for everybody that gets a chance to use it.
Johanna Newman is with the nonprofit Environment America Research and Policy Center. She says companies are starting to put solar on warehouses like this one and big box stores like IKEA, but very, very slowly.
The roofs of superstores and warehouses really are perfect for solar because they're flat, they're sunny, and right now all they're doing is keeping the rain out.
Newman says if all the warehouses and big box stores in Indiana put solar on the roof, it could power more than 20% of all the homes in the state. There are also advantages to generating energy close to where it's used. Newman says 9 out of 10 Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart. If they all had solar and battery storage, she said Walmarts could become resilient community hubs.
In the event of a tornado or in the event of a hurricane, Walmart still has power and it still has light and it has refrigeration and could become the place where people go to charge their phones and where they can go to get cool water.
So why aren't more businesses doing this? Newman says there are a number of reasons. She says solar would undoubtedly save a big energy-hogging store like a Target money in the long run, but there's still an upfront cost.
So anything that doesn't pay back within 2 to 3 years, they can struggle to justify to their shareholders.
Solar on a warehouse, on the other hand, would probably generate more energy than what the warehouse itself can use. Unless it can sell that energy to someone, like a utility or a community solar project, Newman says it might not make financial sense. That's where Indiana lawmakers can make the difference.
So if there are state incentives that are put in place to help encourage solar on the built environment, like superstore roofs and warehouse roofs, you can change the business calculation of the solar developers.
Things like higher rates for net metering. Those are the credits folks with solar panels get on their electric bills for sending excess energy back to the grid. Indiana's large investor-owned utilities lobbied to pass a law 8 years ago to phase down higher net metering rates. Reinstating them would help big box stores and warehouses pay off their solar panels faster. It certainly worked for Sweetwater, which got a better net metering rate from its rural electric cooperative. Altogether, the company says having solar saves it more than $160,000 a year. But Jeff Osterman, Sweetwater's chief people and culture officer, says that's not what drove Sweetwater to do it. He says the company has always tried to be an environmental steward. It's something customers want to see.
We were excited to be able to do it. And I think what we found out in the process is it was actually way more accessible for us than maybe what we had even initially realized. And I think others who would be looking at it, other organizations, may very well find the same thing.
To avoid the worst effects of climate change, scientists say we need to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. That means transitioning toward cleaner sources of energy like solar fast. Solar developers say a patchwork of local laws in Indiana make putting large solar farms on the ground difficult. Indiana's warehouses and big box stores may be a creative way to get some of that solar back on the roof. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
And now we're joined on the Friday Wrap by Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel. Thanks for joining me today, Rebecca. Always nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm always curious how you come across the stories that you report on. Can you tell me how you learned about this and what interested you in this topic?
You know, this story has been such a long time coming. I'm not entirely sure that I can actually remember, but I feel like it had something to do with finding out that IKEA's roof in Fishers was covered in solar panels and just thinking, wow, there aren't that many ways to get big utility scale solar on a roof, but this is one way to do it. And, you know, thinking about that and then all of these conflicts that we have in rural parts of Indiana over putting solar on the ground, it just really made sense to talk about a solution that could kind of bring everyone together.
Yeah, and you focus on Sweetwater Sound there in Fort Wayne. In your lead that you mentioned, the increase in Indiana solar over the next 5 years is going to be pretty large. I'm wondering, if does the state have an overall energy plan, and how does solar fit into that plan?
Yeah, so I want to, before we talk about that, I kind of want to talk about the renewable portfolio standard, because that's generally what we think of when we think of a statewide energy plan for something like solar. That's basically a goal that some states have for how much of their power should come from clean energy by a certain date. Indiana doesn't currently have one. We did have a goal of 10% clean energy by this year, actually, which we surpassed a few years ago. Now about 13% of Indiana's energy comes from things like wind, solar, and hydro, etc. But even then, that was voluntary. No one's feet were really held to the fire. So now, as of 2 years ago, lawmakers passed a bill that set up what we now call Indiana's statewide energy plan. It's not a portfolio standard. There's not really a date for this much solar at this time. That being said, it basically says energy regulators, the IURC, the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, has to consider five things when it makes its decisions for what utilities are allowed to charge ratepayers for. So, and those five things are reliability, affordability, resiliency, stability, and environmental sustainability. So we know that obviously solar doesn't need fuel to run, so that makes it better for the environment. So that's that one. And then in many cases, cheaper. So there's affordability. So that's actually been the reason why utilities have added a lot of solar in the past few years, is the cost. Those other five utilities say it isn't quite as reliable. The sun isn't always shining. And, you know, that's kind of the tension point that we see in a lot of these conversations around the state when it comes to, should we build this new natural gas plant or should we build out more solar? So we have a statewide energy plan, and solar definitely fits into that, but it's not a one-to-one connection like what we might see with a renewable portfolio standard. It's not a set goal by a certain time.
That kind of leads into my next question. Center points that we have here in the Evansville area, Duke, across much of the rest of the state, it seems like then they are pretty big players in this policy and the decisions being made going forward.
Definitely. So both of those utilities are looking to eventually get about half their energy from solar power. That's a lot of panels. That's a lot of ground that they're going to look to try and find out where they're going to place that solar. And especially in a state like Indiana, where many counties have some pretty big restrictions on where that solar can go. But the timeline for both of these utilities couldn't be more different. CenterPoint hopes to have about half solar by 2030. Duke Energy would reach that goal 14 years later. And just as a reminder, we said this in the story, but the Paris Climate Agreement says we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions significantly by 2030. So the fact that Duke isn't planning to add most of its renewables until the 2030s, and also keep its Gibson coal plant running, is notable. The Sierra Club releases an annual report looking into utilities and if they're making good on their climate pledges. Last year, Duke Energy got an F. CenterPoint got a B.
Well, let's go back to the stores. Speaking of Sweetwater, which is in Fort Wayne, are there incentives for, companies, small businesses, medium-sized business, or even national companies to install solar panels on their rooftops?
Specifically state incentives? Not really right now, not that I'm aware of. As we kind of discussed in the story, net metering was also sort of served as that incentive for commercial as well as residential solar. But because we have...
That's where you can sell your power back to the power provider, is that right?
Basically, yeah. Basically, you kind of, it's more like a discount on bills, I guess, is a better comparison. So they kind of take the difference between the solar that you're giving back to the grid and the energy that you're actually using that maybe it doesn't cover. And then there's a dollar amount assigned to that solar that goes back to the grid. So, right. But at any rate, that now that we have lower net metering rates, you don't get as much for that solar. There's not really a state incentive that I'm aware of. And though there are federal investment and production tax credits for clean energy, some of those credits are actually on the chopping block right now in the House budget plan. So, you know, there's a lot of things in motion. It's not really clear what's going to stick around. So that does kind of make this even harder for a commercial business to decide, is this something I really want to do?
Yeah, and that just leads into my final question for you. Did you find or learn about other companies or warehouse owners that are planning to move forward with solar panel installation on their rooftop, or are they pausing that to see how things play out with, you know, tariffs and tax credits and everything else?
You know, surprisingly, not very many companies that I've found are very vocal about their solar, unless it's a corporate-wide effort. So we did mention IKEA and Fisher's. That's one. IKEA, almost across the country, you're going to see solar panels on their rooftops. There's also a real estate and logistics investment company called Prologis, and they have a building in Indianapolis, which the Solar Energy Industries Association says is one of the largest corporate solar installations in Indiana. But those are the only ones that I know of right now. I should mention Bendix Commercial Vehicle Systems, which makes auto components, I believe, has a large solar array on its property, but that one is on the ground. So, yeah, there isn't a lot of news about this, honestly.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for your time today, and always thank you very much for your great reporting. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks again.
All right, that's Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel on the Friday Wrap, and we'll be back after this.
It's the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. Good to have you along on this Friday. Well, joining me now is Jevin Redman with this week's Sports Chat. Jevin, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, John.
All right. Well, what a game one of the NBA Finals last night. As I understand it, the Indiana Pacers were behind the entire game until the very last second, correct?
They had one lead, and it came with 0.3 seconds, thanks to a shot from Tyrese Haliburton. The Pacers win game one of the NBA Finals on the road at the Oklahoma City Thunder, 111-110. And this is a bit of a unique NBA Finals because you have two small market teams going at it.
Right.
And the Pacers, their second trip ever to the Finals in their NBA history, the first since 2000. So you have really two franchises on a stage they're not used to playing on.
Right.
But the Pacers, this has not been unfamiliar territory for them in this playoffs. It's really been remarkable. They're almost a team of destiny. Quite a few comebacks really throughout now all four series. But John, last night they trailed by 15 points early in the fourth quarter. We mentioned just one lead at the very end. But if you look at their whole playoff picture, here's a remarkable stat.
Yeah.
They've had four games in the fourth quarter where their winning percentage based off various factors was 4% or less. They won all four of those games.
Wow.
The odds of that happening, 1 in 1.5 million. So maybe it is a team of destiny. The Pacers 3 wins away from the first ever NBA championship. Game two is on Sunday night at Oklahoma City at 7 o'clock.
Yes, indeed. We will certainly be following that series. Well, as I understand it, Jevin, you have news on high school baseball and softball. There's still action going on.
Yeah, right? And still a busy time, really, for the Tri-State. Quite a few teams playing still in the postseason. We'll start with high school baseball and kind of work our way down. But in Class 4A, Evansville North will play the regional game tomorrow against Seymour. It's at Bossy Field. 12 noon is the first pitch. North won their first sectional since 2013. Last weekend, weekend. In Class 3A, you have Evansville Central taking on Jasper. That game is at Jasper at 10 a.m. tomorrow. For Evansville Central, it's their first sectional championship since 2017, and they're really an underdog. They're just 10-17 on the season. They upset Memorial last week in the championship. The Tigers were 19-4, so Evansville Central writing a bit of a Cinderella story. And then in Class 2A, you have Evansville Modern Day playing Bar Eve at 10 a.m. That is the first game of the day at Bossy Field tomorrow. Modern Day won their first sectional championship since 2014. So three Evansville schools that are playing the region for the first time in several years. Yeah. And John will finish up with high school softball semi-state. Evansville Memorial will play Charlestown tomorrow at 10 a.m. That's at Jasper High School. And then in Class 2A semi-state, Tecumseh, who's now won four straight regionals, they play Monrovia at 10 a.m. tomorrow at Forest Park. So a lot of baseball and softball to watch tomorrow.
No doubt. Also, still some college baseball to talk about, right?
Yeah, so Murray State baseball, they're playing in the Super Regional this weekend. They're at Duke. It's a best-of-three series. Whoever wins that series goes to College World Series. And if you remember, last year, Evans was in that situation playing at Tennessee. It really is remarkable for mid-major schools to get to this point in the college baseball postseason and for the Missouri Valley Conference. Now, three straight years, a team has made the Super Regional. Indiana State in 2023, Evans last year, now Murray State. So the Racers having a great season. They'll take on Duke this week in a three-game set.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned some high school baseball happening at Bossy Field tomorrow. We've also got the Otters in town, right?
Yeah, so the Otters have a three-game series with the Washington Wild Things. They'll play at 6:35 tonight and tomorrow, and then 5:35 on Sunday. But the Otters, they're going for a third straight win tonight. They've gotten off to a bit of a slow start, maybe starting to find their winning ways with a couple of wins here. But they're 10-13 overall, three games back of first place still early in the season. But the team they're chasing is the Wild Things, who they play this weekend at Bossy Field.
Yeah. Now, in Major League Baseball, we're beyond the Memorial Day weekend now. About that time of the season where you really start determining who might be winners, who might be losers, and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, probably still just a bit too early to start watching the standings, but a good point. I think this is kind of the timeline where you figure out whether you're going to be a contender or not. And St. Louis Cardinals and Chicago Cubs right now in the top half of the National League Central standings. The Cubs, 39-23, they have a five-game lead on St. Louis. The Cubs play the Tigers this weekend in Detroit. Those two teams have the two best records in Major League Baseball. The Tigers are 41-23. But, you know, I think for many Cardinal fans throughout the tri-state, they had to be pleased with how their team is playing. This was somewhat of a rebuild year, but their young talent and pitching coming through right now. They're 34-28, just a half game out of a wild card spot behind the Giants. Again, still too early to talk standings and whatnot, but the Cardinals have been very competitive to this point.
Yes, indeed. Well, anything else to add, Jevin, that we haven't touched on here?
No, just quite a bit going on. You know, typically get in the summer months here in June and things start to slow down, but not really the case with the Pacers still playing. You've got a lot of high school baseball and softball postseason, mentioned college baseball with Murray State. So a lot going on, and makes the summer months fun.
Yes, indeed. The Stanley Cup Finals continuing as well. That is Jevin Redman with WNIN's Sports Chat. As always, Jevin, thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thanks, John.
All right. Well, coming up on the Friday Wrap, we will run down the weekend notebook. We hope you'll stay with us here at WNIN-FM. It's the Friday Wrap on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson, and it's time for the Weekend Notebook. Many things going on around the tri-state this weekend. Let's start with tonight. We have a First Friday at Haney's Corner. This monthly event features artists, live music, vendors, food trucks, and more, all happening in the Haney's Corner Arts District. Musicians also perform at nearby Patchwork Central on Washington Avenue and at First Presbyterian Church on 2nd Street. Again, tonight is a First Friday at Haney's Corner. Moving on to tomorrow, Saturday, we have a Hobstadt Townwide Yard Sale. You can find treasures all over the Gibson County town. The event is conducted by the town of Hobstadt. It starts at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Again, that's the Hobstadt Townwide Yard Sale beginning at 7 a.m. in Hobstadt. Also happening on Saturday, the Evansville Brick Convention, that is, at Old National Events Plaza. Lego fans can learn and enjoy creations from Lego Masters during four sessions, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. both Saturday and Sunday. The sessions are repeated. Tickets for this event are $20. Part of the proceeds go to Creations for Charity. That's an organization that buys Legos for underprivileged kids. Again, that's the Evansville Brick Convention at Old National Events Plaza, happening tomorrow and Sunday. Also happening on Saturday, a Juneteenth celebration at Bayard Park. This sixth annual block party-style celebration is from noon to 7 p.m. at the park off South Kentucky Avenue here in Evansville. You'll find cultural exhibits, live music, food trucks, a kid zone, and more. Again, that Juneteenth celebration happening at Bayard Park from noon to 7 tomorrow. Here in downtown Evansville tomorrow, it's the fifth annual Pride Festival and Parade. River City Pride is hosting a day of events to kick off Pride Month. The parade and festival begin at noon here at Main and Riverside in downtown Evansville. The free event includes vendors, food trucks, and entertainment. That all happens from 1 p.m. to 10 p.m. Again, the parade starts at noon tomorrow for the fifth annual Pride Festival. That's kicks off at noon here at Riverside and Main in downtown Evansville. Meanwhile, over in downtown Henderson, we have the Henderson Porch Fest. This free, family-friendly event features eight musical acts, each performing on front porches along South Main Street. Performers include King's Highway, Soul in the Pocket, and Southbound 41. The Porch Fest is from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. tomorrow along South Main Street in Henderson. Moving on to Sunday now, it's Art in the Garden. This event by the Southwestern Indiana Master Gardeners Association is from noon to 4 p.m. at the group's display garden off the Lloyd Expressway east of Van Avenue. You'll find arts and craft booths, food trucks, family activities, and music by the Honeyvines. Admission to the Art in the Garden event is free. If you have an event you'd like us to mention here on the Weekend Notebook, send it to me. That's jgibson at wnin.org, and we'll do our best to get your event on the Weekend Notebook. That will wrap up the Friday wrap for this week. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including John Martin of Evansville Living Magazine. A big thanks to WNIN's Tim Jagalow, as well as WNIN's Kenton McDonald and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel. A big thanks to Jevin Redman, not only for the sports chat, but for engineering today's show. Thanks to Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations for their support. Thanks to listeners like you, of course. Without your support, we can't bring you programs like the Friday Wrap. And for this Friday, that is a wrap.